This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We tape in the offices of Rader Solutions. Rader creates and maintains technical strategies for businesses of all sizes, offering a complete fleet of IT solutions. You just want it to work, we understand, is Rader's motto. If you're wondering if Rader can help your business, please visit RaderSolutions.com. Lafayette Convention and Visitors Commission also provides underwriting for Discover Lafayette. To find out more about our local restaurants, festivals, music scene, and much more, please visit LafayetteTravel.com. Today's interview is our second one with Paul Hilliard, who founded Badger Oil in 1955. Today, we'll ask Paul to reflect on the World War II generation and what it was like when the U.S. entered the war. And as Paul has said before, this is the story about how the war changed the world. Paul, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank
yeah. You. So we spoke earlier this year, and we went over your whole, you know, growing up in Wisconsin and what led you to Louisiana. But I think a deeper dive into your experience as a young man, you know, the Depression era, coming out of that and then entering World War II, if we can focus on your service and how that changed your life, I'd love to hear more about that story.
I've been told by more than one person that I never grew up. I did get older, but so anyway, and but there's it's been a lot of fun, and but the war was in a not only different, it was a different century, but it's a different country, and it's so distant now. Mm-hmm. It's like a different planet, and I'm not sure it really happened. And I read a lot about it. Mm-hmm. I love history and always have. And I read more about it. And I sometimes say, well, did I read about it or did that actually happen? And
such a different world. I think I mentioned to you what really got me wanting to have you back on the show was when I met Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole,
yeah,
who I wasn't familiar with. I had heard about the Doolittle Raid, mm-hmm, and that was the first raid, I think, over Tokyo by the U.S. retaliating after Pearl Harbor. But he is now 103, and I realized that even though I had studied history, I should have known about him. And it was a different era. In the age of selfies, Paul, the selfless sacrifice of young men like you and your... How old were you when you enlisted?
I was 17.
Yeah. Without even thinking,
you didn't. Teenagers don't have to think, you know. You don't have to know anything. You don't even have to suspect anything if you're a teenager.
Bulletproof, yeah.
Right, invisible, invulnerable, and all of the above. But it was, I don't know. It was a thing to do. If you look at the demographics in 1940, I mean, we were, by today's standards, a third world country.
Mm-hmm. As far as education?
A lot of things. A third of American homes had no electricity or running water, and about a quarter of the population lived on the farms. You had less than 25% of American adults had a high school diploma. Less than 3% a college, mm-hmm, degree. So it was, formal education was a luxury then. But it was only a nation of about 132 million versus, mm-hmm, 230 now. So there were 200 million fewer people in the country. But to some extent that may have influenced the outcome of the war. I think sometimes I think, you know, that next time the Germans or the Japs decide to take on an enemy, mm-hmm, don't take on somebody just coming out of a 10-year depression and a 7-year drought. So
yeah, the scrappers.
Because as a kid, you know, on the farm, I mean, and I remember, the Depression just meant no one had any money. So if no one has any money, then you're not poor, you're not rich, you just mm-hmm. you don't have any money. And so, but I, the thing I do remember most vividly is the drought on the farm, and the that was demoralizing to see your crops, and right. having to sell calves and hogs because they couldn't feed them, and that was that's a drought on the farm is not a fun deal. So, mm-hmm. but I think a lot of us who went in the service and early in the war, we didn't suffer or sacrifice because I mean, you know, the Marine Corps, me and I went in, and it'll be 70. How long? 76 years. In February, going in as a farm kid, and they're going to pay you $50 a month, and food, clothing, shelter, right. exercise, discipline, all of the above. It was it wasn't tough compared to the mm-hmm. days on the farm, not really.
So you yeah. enlisted right after high school?
I quit high school in February of 43. I was a senior, and I finally persuaded my mother to sign. Mm-hmm. And so I went in February, and then when I finished boot camp and rifle range and so on, it's standard in the Marine Corps, they said, tomorrow you're going to take an aviation radio and radar aptitude test. And well, I didn't think that was any job for the Marines. And we didn't even own a radio, mm-hmm. and radar was something I'd heard of but really didn't understand. And so I said, well, I don't know anything about those two things. And they said, looked at me like I was deaf, and they said, tomorrow you're going to take an aviation radio and radar aptitude test. So I took the test. They never told me if I passed or what I did. All I know is about 3 days later, they hand me my orders. You're going to Jacksonville, Florida, the Naval Air Station, to aviation radio and radar school. So. Mm-hmm. I ended up there, and then we finished that in the fall of 43, and then gunnery school and operational training, and then they sent us back to San Diego, and we traveled by train then. There was no air travel, really, other than military aircraft. So,
can you explain what a gunner is?
Well, the means you handle guns. In aviation, it meant that you ride around an airplane and handle the machine guns, you know, either nose, tail, mm-hmm. side, top, bottom, wherever it is. But I ended up in, it's kind of funny because we lived on near the right on the edge of a small town, and I had a newspaper route in 1941, and I don't know, not many papers, but it's a small town, but I remember reading about the Battle of Midway and about the SBD, the Dauntless Dive Bombers, mm-hmm. sinking those four Jap carriers. And I thought that was really interesting, but I never had any idea I'd end up in the back seat of one of those things. So
right.
it was weird because I remembered that there. It's a great story about the Battle of Midway, and which was maybe one of the turning points, certainly, in the Pacific War, 6 months after Pearl Harbor. So I remember reading about it, but I never envisioned
right.
riding around one of those things.
Right. So yeah. What was it like? I guess I'd like to hear about, you were so young, leaving home, World War. I mean, do you remember day to day, like, were you did you feel it was just your duty? Did you feel once you were there, was it like, oh no, I should have, you know, done something else? Or
I don't know, I never thought of any alternative. But is when you're, you know, 16, 17 years old, and you're about as full grown as you're going to get, and you're walking down the street in a small town in the Midwest, well, you just knew that their mothers and sisters and maybe daughters looking at you saying, I wonder why that guy is not in the military. I wonder if he's 4F. I wonder if he's a draft dodger, and so on. But it's so it was I was anxious to go. I had my older brother was in the Navy, and a lot of the guys in that were a year or two ahead of me in high school were already in service, and a lot of them overseas. So
it was really expected.
I never yeah. considered the alternative, and but it was America was a different planet than it is today.
Can you talk about that some? You know, your thoughts on that?
It's a pretty simple way of life, and you didn't travel much. I had been as far as Minneapolis. My aunt took me when I was about 10 years old, Minneapolis, and I got to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and saw my first aircraft up close in out of Old Chamberlain Field, I know when we were on the farm, an aircraft went over, and this is, they weren't on, not many of them on oxygen yet, so they were all below 12,000 feet. And you'd run out and see if you could see that airplane, because you hear the thing. And so you knew every farmer in the whole neighborhood, unless he was riding a tractor or something, he was going to be out looking at that airplane, because it was a big deal.
Right.
So it was... by today's standards, is somewhat primitive, but you know, being a volunteer in World War II was no big deal, because there were about 16 million men and several thousand women that served between 1940 and 1946, and of those 16 million, about 6 million were volunteers, a lot of them teenagers. So there was nothing unique about me going to the Marine Corps.
With the recent death of George H.W. Bush, I think people have really stopped to think about how much things have changed. You know, the lifetime of service and the civility that he kept, as opposed to the way people seem to conduct themselves in the media these days. I think his death really brought home how much things have changed in our society.
Yeah. So. Obviously, I think that's the case, but it was. I think also that the Germany had been running wild in Europe by then, and all of Western Europe was under German domination. They were looked like they might prevail even in the Soviet Union, which is a
frightening thought.
And the word was out about the way the Japs treated the other Orientals and their intentions to dominate the Pacific, and I don't know if it was patriotism or not, but it seemed like it was the thing you had to do, because they say that, well, we're going to enslave the world. And I guess a lot of young men said, hell, you're not.
Right.
So here the hell you are. So anyway, it was, I don't think, you know, being a volunteer was no big deal. A lot of us felt that if we volunteered, we could pick our branch of service, and I wanted to go in the Marine Corps. And I had about four uncles in the Army, and one in the Coast Guard, and an older brother in the Navy. And none of them sounded too appetizing, so I said, well, I'm going to join the Marine Corps. So I hitchhiked to Milwaukee, and which way we traveled then.
Right.
And we didn't have any money, so, but you could they were pretty good about picking you up back then.
And letting you get out of the car in one piece, huh?
And then, yeah, right.
Safe.
But then when we were in uniform, it was either train or hitchhiking. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of hitchhiking during the war, and it wasn't a big problem. They were happy to pick up servicemen, I think.
Right. So how long did you serve? What was your length of your career?
I was in 37 months on active duty, and I got out in June of 46. But they sent us overseas in late summer of 44, and first to the Solomons, which is and not a place I need to go back to see. I don't need to revisit. But and then in late 44, they put us aboard an old ship, and it had been retrofitted. I think it was an Australian cattle ship, because being a farm boy, I had cleaned barns, and I recognized the aroma. And but they retrofitted it all, and they had the ground crews of our squadron, and probably they had the whole air group ground crews on there, plus half the flight crews, because half of them flew and half of them went aboard ship, because there were two crews per plane. And but that was one of the more interesting aspects of my time overseas. Well, that I was on that ship for about a month, and everybody slept on the on deck, on top of a truck or anything you could, any place you could find, because it was too hot down below deck, and plus it stunk. So we were on that thing, and I don't know why they took the route they did, but we went to New Guinea first and anchored offshore on the north side of New Guinea, which is a big island, and then retraced our steps, our course part of the way back around to the eastern tip of New Guinea, and then back to, after we were in Kuroan, and we spent Christmas, I remember, of 44 in ashore for about a week in an old forward field hospital. And they'd moved it forward, and so I remember, but after Christmas of 44, they put us back aboard ship, and we went to join a convoy at Ulithi, which by then was a big staging base in the Western Pacific, and it was sort of the Pearl Harbor of Western Pacific, and lots of ships there, because we were part of the invasion in of the Philippines, which was unusual, because there weren't many Marines in the Philippines, but they sent two air groups of dive bombers and to fly for MacArthur's army. So we ended up in the Marines flying for the army, but so we went ashore in early January 45 in Luzon, about 100 miles or so north of Manila. The CBs had scratched an airstrip out of the rice field, and so we started flying out of there, and we were on Luzon for about 3 months, flying for the Army and like close support missions, airborne artillery, this would be. So, and then I think probably April, when Manila was considered secure, we flew down then to long hop down to Zamboanga, Mindanao, which is right near the end of the world. And between Mindanao and Borneo, you're near the end of the world.
Is that it?
Right. Here you can see the end of the world from there. Mm-hmm. And we were there until late July. And then they said, you got 30 minutes to get ready and get in the plane. You're going back to the States for reassignment. And I remember one of the gunners saying, just give me 30 seconds to find my toothbrush, and I'm out of here. So they flew us to Guam, and then put us aboard a lot better ship, a lot nicer ship.
So you've had no desire.
But still.
You've had no desire to go back and see that.
But still sleeping on deck, because it's hot out there.
Right.
And so I got back, and they stopped for some reason at San Francisco. And I remember a trip coming under the Golden Gate Bridge. That's an unforgettable sight. And
I bet. Man.
So they let us go ashore. We didn't spend the night, but for a few hours. And I remember I walked in, I went in a restaurant, and I ordered a green salad, because that was a luxury in the Pacific. And so then I ordered another one, and then I ordered, and I think I ate five of them, and she only charged me for one of them. Remember that?
I bet that was delicious.
So, I still loved green salad. So then down to San Diego and new equipment and so on, and a 30-day leave. And then while I was I think while I was on the train between San Diego and Chicago, they dropped the first A-bomb, which we didn't know what it was, but we knew it was maybe going to change things rapidly. And I believe the night I got home in Wisconsin, they dropped the second one, and then about a week later, the Jap says, I think that's enough. Mm-hmm. And so then I was reporting to Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station in North Carolina. And when I got there, then I flew as a radio man in transports until I was discharged.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what did people think, your friends, the people that you were in the Marines with, were they in favor of dropping the bomb to end it, to end the war?
We were just in favor of ending the war. I mean, and the idea of dropping the bomb or not dropping the bomb, that didn't come until later.
When people questioned?
The only thing was the war was over,
right,
and rationing was over, and all that sort of business and so on.
Yeah, because we had talked about that on our first interview, between the Depression, where people couldn't buy things, and then rationing during World War II. It was a long, dry spell for the U.S.
Well, you know, I wasn't aware of it then, but you read about it now, and the Americans have a very brief institutional memory, and they were ready to get the war to be over. So by the end of 44, by the time we started action in the Philippines, or at least on Luzon, the leadership in Washington said the Americans are getting tired of this. They don't like the rationing. They don't like the shortages of this and that. And you can't buy tires. You can't buy gas. Mm-hmm. You can't buy sugar. And they said, we got to get this war over with. And I've never even considered the alternative. Truman had to do what he had to do, which is drop the bomb. He couldn't very well say, for humanitarian reasons, don't drop it. Let's just starve them to death, which is what was happening.
In Japan.
If he'd invaded Japan without dropping the bomb, then he's got to account to every American mother for the loss of life. And when they said, why didn't you drop the bomb? So I don't think he had any choice. And I don't think most people would argue today to the contrary to that.
Yeah. I've tried to explain to my girls, like, just the technological changes that have occurred in my lifetime. But looking back, I mean, after the war, there was no interstate system. I mean, that's just why everything boomed. Y'all could finally drive, produce tires, produce cars. And then Eisenhower building that highway system really... That's like the iPhone today. That opened up the world.
Well, he built it on a Defense Appropriation Act. He said, if we have another war, we're going to have to figure out how to move stuff in this country. But there's another side note to that. In about 1919, Eisenhower, I think, was a captain. And he was one of those in charge of a convoy, and they do that from the East Coast to the West Coast. And it was an army convoy of trucks and army cars of the 1918-19 version. And they said, if we get in a war in the Pacific, we're going to have to move stuff from the East Coast to the West Coast. And said, highway system is pretty bad, so how long would it take? So they set out in this convoy of trucks and cars, and it only took them 62 days to get from Washington to San Francisco. That's right. Average about 6 miles an hour.
Yeah. Would be like traveling the whole way on the Abbeville Highway or something, you know.
So Eisenhower, that experience probably was one of the factors in 1956. I think he got that bill passed and said, we've got to have a better highway system. And he'd seen the Autobahns.
That's what I read. Yeah, he knew people could move fast.
And he said, we can move at 70 miles an hour instead of 7, you know, if we build a highway system.
So, right.
And that was a great move. And certainly helped build America.
So you're very active with the World War II Museum.
Right.
And I know that for people listening to this is just a snippet of all the experiences, but would you talk about that and what people, I don't know what the current, if there's a big exhibit right now or if there's anything.
There's always a big exhibit.
Yeah.
There's
the whole museum is fascinating.
$450 million project,
mm-hmm.
almost $500 million by the time it's finished. And right now there's about $100 million worth under construction. And it's, I think last fiscal year, which ended June 30th, we had 760,000 visitors for the year.
Wow.
And that's increasing. So I guess a couple more years, we'll be close to 1 million visitors a year. Mm-hmm. But they're doing a lot of online stuff. They got to take the museum online. Everyone can't come to New Orleans. And mm-hmm. we've had maybe 6 million visitors since it opened in 2000. But that's not many when you consider we have 330 million people mm-hmm. in this country. So they're doing a lot of online stuff, including an online program with Arizona State, where you can actually get a degree, a history degree, especially in through online.
Wow.
Through the museum in Arizona State. So
that's a progressive university. They're on top of things.
It's fast moving, mm-hmm. but. We've got to take the museum out to the public, to schools, and so on. We get a lot of school groups there, but they can't all come there.
Right.
So you got to take it out to them. It's just which is the way the world's moving mm-hmm. today. So
are there videos online, like things
you
can search?
Go to the website.
Yeah,
and you'll see,
I've looked on the site, but I didn't think to look for educational.
Yeah. And tools. Then we have a lot of trips abroad mm-hmm. to battlefield sites, and my wife and I did the Mediterranean, and early this year we did the Pacific, mm-hmm. and including Iwo Jima and Saipan, Tinian, Guam, and a little known battle site called Peleliu, which is probably one of those battles that shouldn't have been fought, but it was bad stuff for the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. and I got a taste of the climate in the Philippines because it was only about 600-700 miles from Mindanao, which was where I was last based. And it's hot and humid there year round, mm-hmm. every day, every night. But the Pacific War was so different. It was island by island, and Normandy gets a lot of attention, but it's mm-hmm. deservedly so, because not only that is Europe is the land of our ancestors. I don't have any ancestors in the Philippines or the Solomons, as far as I know.
And, but you never know.
The Europe, though, but the success at Normandy, when you think about it, was mm-hmm. more than just a lodgment on the European continent. It was the beginning of liberation for millions of people that mm-hmm. suffered horribly under the Nazis. And so,
and their direct ancestors, like you're saying, there were more Americans that were from Europe.
Right. Oh, yeah. We were in Italy a couple of months ago, and they're talking about all the Italians in the army, and they had no shortage of interpreters. There were so many first generation, second generation
right.
Italians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same way in Europe, and Germans, and in France. I mean, you had a lot of Cajuns that were interpreters mm-hmm. for the army, and did a lot of stuff behind the lines. There's some great stories about some of the Cajuns that served in the army in Europe. Some wonderful stories.
I need to find out more about that.
We'll call Pat Meir. I think Pat Meir would know about that. I think he's done a video, actually.
Cool. Yeah, I will. I will follow up. Maybe he can come on this show.
Absolutely. Get Pat on here.
Yeah. When I used to think of World War II, I always thought the European War, and then I mentioned to you before, my father-in-law, he's deceased, but Judge Bill Swift flew a B-24 in the Pacific. And he was older than you, but I really didn't know much about it until I got to know him. Yeah. I didn't realize, you know, my lack of education. So,
well, it was a war of vast distances, and mm-hmm. you know, Victor Davis Hanson wrote a book. No, it wasn't. No, it was Paul Kennedy, I think, wrote a book called Engineers of Victory. It's a great book, and he called it the tyranny of distance. He said, well, you know, they look at it there. The staff in Washington looks at it and said, well, how are we going to take the war in Japan? Well, you have to have air power, because in World War II, aircraft became the third dimension in warfare. It was no longer, you know, Paul Revere's day, and one of by land and two of by sea. But
right.
It meant you had to have...
You had to have air power.
You couldn't exercise your land or your naval option if you didn't control the air. Very difficult to do, as the enemy discovered. So we built, in 4 years, almost 300,000 military aircraft.
That's incredible.
More than our allies, all the allies combined. And by the end of the war, we were produced more stuff than our enemies and our allies combined. So it's America's productivity was a key to the victory. And the Germans might have had better tanks. We had 10 times as many, so it just overpowered them and outproduced them. And same with oil. I mean, neither Germany nor Japan had any oil. Here you are, you're in the mechanized age, and you go to war, with ships and planes and trucks and tanks. But you have to have fuel for them, so they were going to go take it away from the enemy, and that turned out to be
bad move.
Bad news for them.
And yeah.
Hitler, when he started the war, the nearest oil source to Berlin was about 1,000 miles away in Romania, in Ploiesti, and for the Japs, it was probably 3,000 miles from Tokyo to the nearest oil source, yet they start a war against the country that they've been supplying them with the oil. So, it doesn't make any sense, but they did a lot of damage before they were defeated.
Mm-hmm. You were mentioning Paul Kennedy. What are some other good, I know you read a lot, Paul, what are some other good resources if people really want to check out some good books or good...
Well, there's several thousand of them.
Yeah,
and
but you mentioned that one in particular.
I like the book because he broke it into his, five chapters, and he takes on a segment of the war in the war in the Pacific. He refers to the tyranny of distance because I can remember being aboard that ship and one of the gunners in the squadron said, you got to go figure it out how we can we got to I know they censor our mail, but we got to be able to tell mom approximately where we are. And so one of them went to the communications officer, and he came back and said just tell mom that you're at least 1,000 miles from where you've been, and you're at least 1,000 miles from where you're going, and she'll know exactly where you are. so the
code.
It was everything was so fast. I mean, it took days by ship to go any place.
Right.
And I think the two moves in June of 1944 was Normandy, and then actually on the same day as the operation on June 6th, the landing forces for to take the Mariana Islands, which includes Saipan and Tinian. Because Tinian, of course, became the big base for our B-29s to bomb Japan. But that was just coincidental, and it's the same day. But the Normandy forces, they have to get across the channel. It's about 100 miles. And the forces that are going to land on Saipan are about 4,000 miles.
Wow!
So it's a long trip by freighter, and I think take a Liberty ship from the Panama Canal to the Western Pacific, taking close to a month at sea. So it was a different type of war.
Did you have any experiences where you thought I'm going to die? Were you in close calls?
I think one of the worst was aboard that ship, because when we left the anchorage of the convoy at Ulithia on route to the Philippines, to the Luzon, we ran into the tail end of a typhoon. And
oh, my goodness.
He's a farm boy that didn't particularly like the water, and I could see the screws on some of the ships come out of the water, and the bow would disappear. And then the bow would show up, that was a rough ride. Fortunately, I didn't get seasick, and I didn't get
good, yeah,
or airsick. But a lot of them did. And at that point, you learn the difference between upwind and downwind.
Oh,
you got your guys
position yourself
barfing over the rail. Bunch of these heroic Marines up, stand at the rail, throwing up.
Yeah, so, but a typhoon, I mean, that's
but
it's a lot to survive.
I remember that vividly, but you know, our missions were, it was a lot of circling the target and a lot of boredom, because we were, when we take off, we didn't know where we were going, and we knew the area, when we got there, then we had forward air controllers on the ground with the Army, and then so we'd circle, mm-hmm. and sometimes it seemed like endless circling, and up at about 12, 13,000 feet, and it was cold up there, because you're in an open cockpit, and
yeah.
it's hot on the ground, but it wasn't probably 60 degrees mm-hmm. up at 12,000 feet, so we'd wait, and nothing to do.
How long would you be up there? Like, how long would a flight last?
Something like 3-4 hours.
Oh, yeah.
5 hours, maybe. But the dive lasted 30 seconds, maybe, mm-hmm. Because you're going not quite straight down. But the dive bomber had dive brakes, so it was a good airplane, it's sturdy and very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't drop bombs, you delivered your bombs. So you dived on the target and drop your bomb. And then if terrain permitting, they'd circle the target and we'd strafe from the back seat, which was my job. So we were radioman gunners, but we very seldom used those mm-hmm. radios, because we weren't that far from the base. But we'd laugh about it. We said, these are Columbus missions. Because when we took off, we didn't know where we were going. And when we reached our destination, we didn't know where we were, but we made a hell of a mess. And and then when we got back to the base, we didn't know where we'd been. And we did it all at government expense. So.
Right, right.
But
you came back. You survived. I mean.
So you survived.
Could have been so different.
Most of us survived.
Yeah, yeah.
Fortunately. I wouldn't be here. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I've seen photos of you. I know that the type of plane that you were in, the SBD, the mm-hmm. dive.
Yeah.
Can you say what that is? So I don't mangle the name of the plane.
Well, SBD means Scout Bomber by Douglas. It was
right.
Built by Douglas Aircraft, but it was called the Dauntless. And
mm-hmm.
Of course, the joke was the SBD stands for slow but deadly.
Yeah.
But it was wasn't very fast airplane, but it was a very effective,
serviceable for
very,
the job.
Very
yeah.
serviceable airplane.
So I know there's at least one, or maybe more than one, on display at the museum.
The one we have at the museum was at Guadalcanal and was brought back to the States and overhauled and mm-hmm. ended up at the bottom of Lake Michigan. So it was fished out of Lake Michigan,
yeah.
finally, and then restored. But then there's which is not unusual. There's about 14 of them been fished out of Lake Michigan.
Okay.
So, and then they have one at the National Museum of Naval Aircraft in over in mm-hmm. Pensacola. That was at Midway.
I saw that. One That's a Midway. Great
yeah.
museum, also
it's
in Pensacola.
A wonderful museum. It is.
Yeah, yeah.
But the museum in New Orleans was kind of unusual, because over half the money raised so far has been private mm-hmm. sources.
That's incredible,
including Boeing aircraft. And there's a building there named after Boeing, and which is appropriate. But we've had some very generous mm-hmm. donors, both companies and individuals. So it's been fun. I've been involved about 14 years, and it's when something's successful, it's more fun.
You know? Always,
yeah.
I saw online that they're worldwide partners, not just in the U.S., but people partnering, right. groups partnering from around the world to make the museum a success.
And we have one board member now lives in London, I think, but he's we have some great board members. Mm-hmm. On that.
Have you kept up with your people you served with through the years? Were you able to keep up with them?
Well, the squadron, the last time they had, I never went to the one of the reunion, but the last one was in 97 in Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. And I was in on a panel at the Nimitz Museum of the Pacific War over in Fredericksburg, Texas a few years ago. And I met one of the pilots, and he I asked him what he flew, and he said SBD, and I said, well, what squadron are you in? He said, 341. I said, so was I. So we were in the same squadron. I never met him.
Really?
No. And, well, the Marines kept enlisted men and officers separate. And you didn't go to officers' quarters unless you were invited. So it was, but he was in there. So but the last squadron reunion was in 97. So
it's been a while.
What, 21
years ago. 21 years, yeah.
I do keep up. I have a guy that wrote me just this year, and he picked up on me through the museum, I guess, and he lives in Kentucky, and he was a radio repairman, and he said, I remember, he remembered me, because he said, you were always scrounging stuff from the Army, so I said, if we get a can of grapefruit juice, canned grapefruit juice or pineapple juice is a big deal.
So right.
We're always looking for little variety of food.
Right.
But that's the only one I know. I lost track of the pilots I flew with. People say, well, what rank were you? I said, well, I was a sergeant. I was just a sergeant. But I'll tell you what, every mission I flew, I had an officer as a chauffeur, so I can't complain about that. So it's pretty important.
Yeah, that's right.
They were all years old or a year too old. Like Bush is a year and 12 days. I know, a year and 6 days older. I think he was born June 6th, 24. I was born June 18th, 25.
Yeah, I knew he was one of the youngest pilots, but you were super young.
I was.
Right.
But had I been a year older, I'd have gone to flight school. But by the time I had a chance to go to flight school, but by then there was a backlog, and those guys ended up packing parachutes or something until the war ended, and then they sent them to China on occupation duty. So I'm glad I didn't do that.
Right. You came back and got your education. I know that your work, your life career in oil and gas speaks for itself. You've been highly successful. Do you think you're... the time in the service is what impacted your drive, Paul, or was that you anyway?
Oh, I don't know. Probably good discipline. And you learn to do without. Mm-hmm. But I was fortunate. I guess I had maybe good DNA, obviously. I'm still alive, so. Education, even though there wasn't a lot of highly educated people on either side of my parents, it was a big thing to them. It was very important to them. And school was as far as they went. My mother never got past eighth grade, and then she was a farm girl, and so they said, well, that's enough, you know. And then she married my dad, and I think in 21. When she was she was born in 02, so she was 19-year-old. But my dad died in 39. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty independent. I mean, going to the Marine Corps was no big deal for me. We had a kid at a farm, and you had to do everything, and you know, and you're just accustomed to it.
Today it's so different. I mean, I'm sure we'd have to put our cell phones away. And
Well, I have four daughters and a lot of grandkids, so I can tell you it's different.
Yeah, you live it.
Yeah, no iPhones, and you know.
Oh, boy. Now, we're here today with Jason Sikora of Raider Solutions. I see you're taking notes. Did you have questions?
I did have a couple of questions. First of all, Paul, thank you for being here. both my parents were in the war, and my wife's grandfather was in the war. He actually was one of the planners of D-Day. But as a child of a baby boomer, trying to conceptualize the Depression and rationing and the idea of a world war is sometimes out of our scope because it is such a different time and we live in such abundance. So thank you again for coming here and speaking. You spoke about how when you went into the service and went into war, you just saw it as your duty. There wasn't really any other feelings about it. But I wanted to ask about when the war was done, when you were done with your service. What was the feeling amongst you and your family and the other servicemen? Was it like a sigh of relief, or was it scary leaving that environment?
No, sure, it wasn't scary. I mean, I never considered staying in service and in uniform in peacetime. That never occurred to me. I know a lot of guys did, but I didn't ever even say I want to get out because I had the GI Bill. Hmm. And which was a huge thing for me and for millions of other guys, because that gave us I got $90 a month, and then I was, as a married student, I got $120, but tuition and books, you see, were paid. Hmm. Now tuition then was not all that expensive, but it was still a lot more money than you could afford it. I couldn't afford to go to school if I had it not been for the GI Bill.
Oh, interesting. And then what was just the feeling about, like, we kind of have these lofty ideas of, yay, we won the war. Was that the feeling, or was it more a sense of relief, like, we can finally work back on our own country, not have to worry about these outside?
Well, me personally, it was just, it was over with. Now I can get back and go to school. I mean, I said before that, you know, for guys coming off a farm and off the Depression and that awful drought, it lasted about 7 years, but the service wasn't too bad, but that didn't mean we wanted to stay. I mean, civilian life looked better, especially with GI Bill. I said, now, you know, I can go to college. I never considered not going to college. And that was one of the better government programs America's ever had, I think.
Yeah,
it
that
sure
and the
was.
Interstate highway system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then my other question was just a little bit more about the museum. Where is it in New Orleans? How do we get more information about it for those who would like to go visit?
It's a great website, NWW2M. It's, you know, National World War II Museum.org.
Okay.
And it says 6 acres and magazine and Higgins and, you know, Higgins is the guy, one of the reasons the museum is there, because when Stephen Ambrose, the historian, went to see Eisenhower to talk to him about being one of the editors of his papers, I think Eisenhower said, well, you're a professor in New Orleans. He said, did you ever meet Andrew Higgins? And Ambrose didn't even know who he was. He said, you know, said, well, he's the man that won the war for us. So, you know, he explained the importance of the Higgins boats and said we could never have made those landings on open beaches around the world without that craft.
Higgins boats.
And we had stolen the design from the Japs, and it was a Marine that saw them. The Japs used that drop ramp, that shell, that flat-bottom boat in China. But the Japs had no need for it. They weren't island hopping. They took the islands without them, but we needed those boats, both in Europe and the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Pacific. So the Higgins was instrumental in bringing it there. So Higgins Boulevard runs right through the middle of the museum.
Oh, excellent. Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Paul, for being here. It's always such a pleasure to hear your stories.
The Higgins boat is a great story in its own.
We'll have to do another one of these. We could go on
definitely
forever.
I know. Have I asked you, I've probably asked you all the obvious questions. Is there anything that you wish I had asked or anything that you've never discussed?
I don't know, probably a lot of things, and I'll think of them later.
Yeah.
I think we covered it pretty well, but it was I think the war proves more than anything, World War II, that the exceptionalism of this country, because what other country sends 16 million mm-hmm. young men around the world to free other people and walks off and without taking anything in return? So,
and actually help rebuild those countries.
Help rebuild mm-hmm. The enemies, mm-hmm. which was turned out to be the right thing to do, and especially considering the follies after World War I and the Versailles Treaty and so on, that's all part of history. But you asked about good books. Stephen Ambrose was a great writer. He's mm-hmm. the guy. He's the visionary really behind the museum in New Orleans. But the guy that worked with Stephen Ambrose, first as a professor at University of New Orleans, and then later as one of the administrators, and as it was CEO at the museum for about 16 years, and was instrumental in turning the museum into what it is today. Mm-hmm. And he just retired. We got a young fellow named Stephen Watson, but museum has been blessed with great mm-hmm. leadership.
And it's wonderful for New Orleans to have something of that magnitude and quality, and not just Bourbon Street, that people will travel to see more about Louisiana.
It is a little different than Bourbon Street.
Yeah. And it's in the Central Business District more.
It's in the Warehouse District, yeah.
The Warehouse District, thank you. It's away from Bourbon Street.
So. 945 Magazine, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's, but the... if you go down there, you'll see they're building the Canopy of Peace right now, which will be not only an icon in New Orleans and Louisiana, but it'll be a national and an international icon when they finish it in about 6 months.
Right.
But it'll be unlike anything mm-hmm. you've seen, and the view from the bridge will be
breathtaking.
It will be incredible.
Yeah. Well, Paul Hilliard. Okay. I'm humbled to have you on our show again, and you're absolutely one of my favorite people. I just love hearing you talk.
glad to be here.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate. I'm blessed. Okay, so that's it.
We're blessed.
I'm blessed.
We're blessed to have you here in our community, and I want to thank our listeners for supporting Discover Lafayette, and again, Jason Sikora with Raider Solutions. Thank you so much for producing our show. So you can find this show and all the shows at discoverlafayette.net, or you can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.